Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Small Animal Practice webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, our CVS Specialist in Veterinary Cardiology and European Specialist in Small Animal Internal Medicine, Domingo Casamian Sarosol. Thank you, Domingo. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, thank you very much, Sammy Joe, thanks everyone for being here. We are going today to go through ventricular arrhythmias in dogs, in particular, although we talk about cats as well. I think we've put this talk as ventricular arrhythmias, when to worry, because I think it's certainly ventricular rhythms is something that sometimes people get confused in practice, and we get lots of questions about ventricular arrhythmias and what to do with them, and you know, whether to give drugs or not give drugs. So I hope that this is this will at least help in decision making, and along the way, as Sammy Joe says, please, I'm very happy for you to ask me something along the way. We don't have that many people in at the moment, so that would be absolutely fine. Also, I would say we're going to have some questions along the way, like this one, like this first one, which we would do as voting system, yep, and then we'll talk through it. So the first thing is, first question is, how would you describe this rhythm? The rhythm that you can see on the ECG. So I've got quite a few ECGs going on in this presentation, obviously. So I will. Well, you can. I think you can potentially read it. But so points 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. So please have a read. I'll give you a few seconds, 20, 30 seconds, and then we'll go forward. Please vote. Thank you. Okay, so basically we have so that the some people think there is sinus rhythm with frequent ventricular premature complexes couplets. Some other people think there's sinus rhythm with frequent ventricular premature complexes, but by Gemini. Okay, so this is a bigeminal rhythm. So this is, yes, sinus rhythm. So we can see, I'll just put the arrow now on, so you can see how we have a sinus beat with a P wave and a QRS complex, and then a ventricular beat, and then again a succession of sinus beats and the ventricular beat, sinus, ventricular, etc. That's called bigeminy. So couplets will be when you have two complexes together, and we'll go through all this today. So what's a ventricular rhythm? Ventricular rhythm is a rhythm that originates from the ventricle. So basically, the normal sinus rhythm, the normal sinus beats, they start at the atria, the right atria, in the sinus nodes. Then the sinus node depolarizes, and then you've got the polarization of the atria up to the AV node, on the left side as well, and that will be the P wave on your ECG. Then you've got a conduction through the AV nodes, which is the PR interval, and then you're going to have depolarization of the ventricle in an organized manner through the His and right and left bundle, the anterior and posterior fascicles, and we're going to have an organized depolarization, a very rapid depolarization through this pathways that can conduct very rapidly the electrical impulse. And that's going to lead to narrow QRS complex. So the P waves are the depolarization of the atria. PR interval will be the kind of conduction through the AV nodes, And then the QRS complex is the depolarization of the ventricle, which is narrow because it goes to the fast channels. When we've got ventricular ectopy, what we have is a focus in the ventricle anywhere, you know, right ventricle, left ventricle, which starts an impulse when it shouldn't start an impulse. And then that impulse is transmitted, rather than being transmitted through these rapid pathways, is transmitted cell to cell. And that's the main reasons why we'll see why there is a wide QRS complex that we always see. So that QRS complex will be formed from this ventricular ectopic focus that depolarize all the ventricles will be wide. Sometimes it will conduct retrogradely and it will have an inverted P wave. But most of the times it's not there. Okay, but that's basically ventricular rhythms start from a focus on the within the ventricles. So what's the ECG appearance? What's the ECG characteristics or features of ventricular rhythms? So first of all, we're going to have, if you look at this, is the picture I've shown you before. This is a ventricular rhythm, and that ventricular ectopic beat, and that ventricular ectopic complex, or that ventricular complex, is wide. So if you are not sure, so when we say wide, what you need to do is to compare always to your sinus beats. You've got a sinus beat here, QRS, you can see how this is much, much wider. So always look for that normal sinus beat. If you're not sure, if you say, well, it might be, you know, I'm not sure if it's wide, you know, look at this, look at that, then what you can do is measure it. So if it's time-wise is more than 70 milliseconds in dogs, then that's abnormal. If it's more than 40 milliseconds in cats, it's abnormal as well. So 70 milliseconds at 50 millimeters per second is going to be like 3.5 liters square millimeters. Okay, and then 40 milliseconds will be a couple of small squares or millimeters. The second characteristic, other than being wide, is that they are bizarre. SAR means that they are abnormal. They are very different to what a QRS complex looks like. And again, if we point the arrow, we can compare those two and we can see how different they are and how bizarre it might look. Also, always not just look at the QRS complex, but look at the T wave. So the repolarization of the ventricles, because of this depolarization has been abnormal, the repolarization is abnormal as well. And then if you compare not only the QRS complex to a normal sinus beat, but you compare also the T waves, I mean, those T waves are telling you that's a ventricular complex. A main fundamental feature is that there's AV dissociation. So that means the P wave, either they are not present because they are buried within the QRS complex or the T wave, or they are not related to the QRS complex. So, you know, you have to be careful. For example, here you might say, oh, is this a T wave? Is this a P wave? And this is a QRS complex. But then what you do is you look at this is actually a T wave, because if you measure from here, so you measure the QT interval, it's always the same in between these two. So it can't be exactly the same all the time. But if you do the PR interval, it's different. Yeah. So here it's going to be different to there, etc., etc. Okay. So you have to be just, if you're not sure whether T wave is a T wave or a P wave, just look and check the QT intervals and the PR interval and see. Basically, on this ECG, there are no clear P waves, really. You've got a T wave, so that's common in. There might be one coming here. I think that's possibly a P wave coming there and there. So they're not related. So the sinus beat is firing independently. So this focus here is firing independently of the focus down here. They're firing at the same time. And often, the depolarization of the atria happens at the same time as the depolarization of the ventricles. So you don't see the P wave. Sometimes, it might happen just slightly earlier. And therefore, you might see the P wave. But then as soon as there is depolarization of the ventricle, then that QRS complex, that P wave is buried into the QRS complex. So those are the four major characteristics of aventricular rhythm. Now I want to go through a few things of nomenclature. It's important to know, what we say when we say escapes, when we say bundle branch, et cetera, bundle branch block appearance, and et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing will be what's a premature and what's escape. So premature versus escape complexes. So a premature beat will be that one where you have, so basically, what curious complex of a sinus beat, and then sinus beat, sinus beat. The next one would be expected here, but you actually have it before that one. So that's a premature complex. This is different to this one here, which is escape complex, which basically you do have a QRS. This is from a Holter recording, and the QRS, T, PQRS. And then the next one should be here, but actually it doesn't happen. And then what you have is a pause, and you've got a sinus pause, and then you've got a ventricular complex, which is escape complex. It's a escape complex coming from a subsidiary pacemaker in the ventricles that are able to generate a ventricular rhythm of a low heart rate, and then that starts when there's no evidence of any electrical impulse coming from above, from supraventricular area. So those subsidiary pacemakers in the ventricles are able to generate those. But these will be escape ones, yeah. So premature versus escape. Sometimes they're on this region, and then sometimes they are called late premature. Or late diastolic ones are called as well sometimes, and those ones are well kind of in between. Okay, but it's important to know the nomenclature. Now, usually ventricular complexes are followed by a compensatory pause. Usually, not always. Usually, supraventricular complexes are followed by a non-compensatory pause. Okay. Now, what does this mean? So basically, if you've got, we're just going to count something. If you've got your QRS complex here, and then the next one is 300 milliseconds, the next one would be expected here. But it doesn't happen because you've got a ventricular complex. Okay. Now, what's happening with the ventricular complex? Basically, the ectopic focus in the ventricle, so we've got the first depolarization, the second depolarization, but then before the third, the P wave has started the depolarization. We've depolarized the atria. You can see the atria coming here. And actually, sorry, that's the T wave. But we haven't depolarized the atria, but we can't see the P wave, but we started to depolarize. The ventricle has started to depolarize, and then both depolarization waves, one going upwards and one going backwards, they met in the middle. Just around that area, okay? If you follow me, fine. That's fine. So what we can see on the ECG is what we can see on the ECG is the obviously the ventricular premature complex, which is the one that has depolarized the ventricle. But that means that the sinus node is not resetted. Sinus node has fire. Doesn't know what's happened down or below himself or below itself. And then it keeps firing at the same heart rate. So what's happened here on the ECG then? So we see QRS complex from the sinus. We have the ectopic. Again, the sinus node has fired this one at 300 milliseconds. It's just we haven't seen it on the ECG. And then it fires the next one at 600 milliseconds. And then if we count the space between this one and this one, yeah, we've got a compensatory pause because it's the double. To the normal measurement. Okay, so the sinus node has not resetted, has not restarted again. It's just basically keeps firing and it believes that everything has gone as normal. Okay, and that's a compensatory pause. So what tends to happen is that you've got an ectopic beat and then you've got a pause. Just got a bit of a pause. Sometimes in sinus, if you've got an supraventricular ectopic, what happens is that supraventricular ectopic will depolarize the sinus node because it starts, maybe here or here, and it's going to depolarize the sinus node before it fires. That means the sinus node is resetted. So it just has to kind of start again. So you lose that cadence. You lose that 300, 300, 300. Okay. So what you're going to find usually with supraventricular is that you don't have a compensatory pulse, and therefore your space, your distance to the next one usually is less. Okay. So it's just around here. And it won't be a multiple, the distance to the next QRS complex, it won't be a multiple or twice the one from any QRS complex. Okay, if you follow me. Now, this is what usually happens, but not always. You can have some what's called intercalated ones, which is a PQRS complex and a ventricular complex and a QRS complex that has not disturbed the normal sinus rhythm. Okay, that's usually because the ventricular complex reached here. It started reach here, and there was just enough time for the sinus beat that was coming, the impulse from the sinus node that was coming to the AV node to the polarized ventricle just after. So it was just basically at the right time for the heart to have enough time to depolarize again. Okay, if you follow me. But basically, I think it's a pragmatic or practical thing. Ventricular complex will have a compensatory pause. Supraventricular complexes won't have this compensatory pause. So usually the pause after a ventricular complex will be a bit longer than that one usually, than that one of a supraventricular complex. Now, further definitions. What's bigeminal, trigeminal, quadrigeminal? Well, we've said before. So bigeminal will be when we have one sinus, two, and ventricular complex, sinus, ventricular complex, etc. We've asked before. Trigeminal will be the same, in the same line, will be 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, quadrigeminal, 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1. Okay. Now, what's couplets or triplets? We can see on this ECG, 50 meters per second, this is a couplet. The two ventricular complex together, it's a couplet. Three ventricular complex together, as you can see on the ECG picture, that's a triplet. Further definition. Well, we have a question now. So I would like to know, just see what you guys, you know, what you use usually, what at what rates a ventricular rhythm. So we said, sorry, couplets, two together, triplets, three together, more than four or more than four, it's a ventricular rhythm. Okay. And now we're going to talk how we describe those ventricular rhythms. It's a rhythm, still not a tachycardia, it's a ventricular rhythm. So we've got four or more ventricular ectopics. So I'd like to know at what rate you call it a ventricular tachycardia. Above 250, above 230, above 180, above 120, or above 100. Got two questions. Some people have replied as 230 and some people above 180. So we've got those two. I'm just going to go through what's the definition. And this is a definition that comes from electrophysiological studies. So it's not a random definition. It comes from electrophysiological studies. So basically, the mechanism of VTAC is usually different. There's a reentrant mechanism, and the idioventricular rhythms, they do have a mechanism of enhanced automaticity. So this is coming from, no, it's not a random thing, basically. So we will call ventricular tachycardia, and this will be important when we discuss treatment as well. So we'll talk about it, but it will be important when we discuss treatment. So ventricular tachycardia, we are going to call any rhythm with a heart rate above 180 beats per minute, both for dogs and cats. Okay, bear this in mind, because obviously cats can have higher heart rates. For VTAC, we still call it 180. Okay. Idioventricular rhythms are going to be those which are usually escape rhythms. What we were saying before, third degree AV block, this escape rhythm coming in, that's an idioventricular rhythm. It's a subsidiary pacemaker in the heart, which is able to generate some sort of impulse. It's not very high heart rate, but it's able to do that, usually through calcium channels. So that's less than 66 beats per minute in dogs. Sorry, that's incorrect on the slide. It's a mistake. 66 in dogs 140 in cats. Okay, so 66, so less than 66 beats per minute in dogs, less than 140 in cats. And in between, we're going to call it accelerated ventricular rhythms. And we'll talk about how important this rhythm is. So this is going to be a rhythm in dogs in between 66 and 180, in cats between 140 and 180 beats per minute. Okay, so these are important definitions. Further definitions or further features of a ventricular rhythm. We do have rhythms that are fast. Yeah, well, as we were saying, a VTAC. We have rhythms that are slow or slower, 110. That will be an accelerated ventricular rhythm. And rhythms that are much slower, below 66. That's going to be an idioventricular rhythm. That's escape rhythm. A third degree block. P waves. There, 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 there. One there. So there's one there. One, one, one. So, and they are not related to the ventricular rhythm, which is an independent, it is a dissociation between the atrial rhythm and the ventricular rhythm. Ventricular rhythm goes slow and is independent, okay? And it goes at 40 beats per minute. VTAC, accelerated ventricular rhythm, idioventricular rhythm or escape rhythm. Now, sometimes looking at the morphology of the ventricular ectopy, you can, I would say, estimate or you could try to guess where it's coming from. Usually, if you've got on the inferior leads, which are lead 2, lead 3, AVF, but usually we're going to look in at most ECGs on lead 2, and you are going to see that the ventricular complex is positive, so has got the same, so it's positive as the QRS complexes, and this is called left bundle branch block appearance. Left bundle branch block appearance, and this is telling you that it's coming most likely from the right ventricle. And this is sometimes important, for example, in dogs with boxers with arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. Because the disease usually starts on the right side. So if you see many of those, then you have to suspect that might be the case. Left ventricle, it will be different. So in lead 2, we are going to have a ventricular, so a QRS complex which has negative polarity. Okay, so it's negative in the inferior leads. You look at lead 2, and that's most likely coming from the left ventricle. Okay, right bundle branch block appearance, left bundle branch block appearance for right ventricle. You're going to look as well at whether the ECG is, as I point with the arrow, whether the ECG is uniform. Okay, so the ECG has got the same appearance along the way. So that's telling you that there is just most likely one focus. Or it's multiform, which is telling you that most likely there are two different focuses. You can see here how we actually have got one potentially right-sided and one potentially left-sided. So that possibly is telling you, with all the caveats, it's telling you that the disease and the Lyme disease is most likely to be diffuse. Okay, so that might be important as well on occasions for treatment. Another two important features of ventricular premature complexes. One is the fission bits, the fission complexes. These happen quite not uncommonly, particularly in idioventricular rhythms. Fission complexes happen when the sinus rhythm and the ventricular rhythm have got a similar heart rate. And what happens is, so you have a sinus node that is firing, and you've got a ventricular rhythm that is firing. Yeah, so here, could use this picture here. Sinus node that is firing, ventricular rhythm that is firing. Sinus node fires, start the depolarization. At the same time, the ventricular rhythm fires, start the depolarization. The sinus node goes to the AV node and start depolarizing the ventricle. And at the same time, the ventricular ectopy is depolarizing the ventricle. So one ventricular depolarization is coming from above, one is coming from below, for example. So they kind of negate each other in terms of the electricity that you observe on the ECG. So you can see those fusion complexes are a very nice example. You've got sinus beats, P QRS complex. Well, P, but it's not followed by a QRS complex because suddenly you've got a ventricular premature complex coming, right bundle branch block, possibly coming from the right. And then the next one, you've got P wave. Actually, both of them, the QRS complex, so the sinus bit and the sinus, the impulse coming from the sinus node and the impulse coming from the ventricular ectopy have negate each other. You got this almost isoelectric, almost flatty line, towards flatty line a complex. Yeah, so aberrant, and then just they're just negating to each other. They're not either positive or negative. They're nothing. Yeah. Okay. So you have to. It's sometimes difficult to differentiate this from a multiform. Yeah, you could say, oh, this is coming from different plates. But this is typical for fusion complexes. Okay, and again, it's just because your heart rates are very similar and they're firing. When the ventricular rhythm is, the heart rate is so much higher, then there's no time for this. So it's all ventricular. If the sinus rate is much higher than a ventricular, then you're not going to see any. The last thing to comment on, which is important as well, will be important for treatment, will be R on T phenomenon. R on T phenomenon. So the R on T basically means when you this description is a description of what happens on the ECG when you have a QRS complex starting at the same time, so at the very much or the very very much time of a T wave. Okay, so if we look at the ECG, we have P QRS T, and when the T is coming, we've got a ventricular premature complex there coming. That's an R on T, and that's risky because that's the period where there's more dispersion of depolarization in the ventricle. So we have some cells that are slightly positive, some others are very positive, some others are negative or more negative, etc. And that's a very good substrate for VF, for ventricular fibrillation. So if we fire an ectopic at that time, we could go into ventricular fibrillation. So if there are, an ectopic is fired at that time. I mean, if we see this on an ECG, we're worried. So we want to stop those ectopics because they are just firing very fast after the a normal sinus beat, or very quick, or very soon after the beat, and it could lead to VF. Usually, we're more worried when the firing is at the ascending part of the T wave rather than the descending part. Okay, but nevertheless, so the earlier, the worse. Now, so we've just gone through the description of the ECG, and we are going to go now through a or talk about underlying diseases. Basically, the best way of looking at this is to look at it from a cardiac or extracardiac cause. So you've got cardiac or extracardiac causes. Cardiac causes, any almost any cardiac disease could cause ventricular ectopic beats. But certainly those causing myocardial disease, which is where, you know, ventricular myocardial disease, which is where the ectopics are coming from, are more likely to cause ventricular ectopy. So those are going to be dilated cardiomyopathy, all sorts of cardiomyopathy, really. But I'm talking about dogs now, and then we'll talk about cats. So for in dogs in particular, dilated cardiomyopathy, a cardiac neoplasia, pericardial disease, any myocardial trauma, myocarditis, myocardial infarcts, inherited arrhythmias. These are basically idiopathic arrhythmias where you've got channel abnormalities and they are born with them and they generate arrhythmias. Less commonly, diseases causing overloads like mitral valve disease, PDA, etc., will cause ventricular ectopy. It can happen, but it will be less commonly. I mean, a common cause of ventricular ectopy in the dog, though, is congestive heart failure. So if you've got congestive heart failure, you're going to have myocardial hypoxia, and it's not uncommon to have VPCs, which might go away. We'll talk about treatment later, but they might go away when you treat the congestive heart failure. So you might have a mitral valve disease dog in congestive heart failure with some ectopics, which might go away when that's treated, or they might, you know, they might become very much infrequent. Now, if you don't find any cause, and we talk about systemic now, either extracardiac or cardiac, this ventricular arrhythmia will be named as idiopathic. And then we'll have to focus. There's no obvious cause. There might be a bit of scar tissue in the ventricles, some change in the cellularity because there's some damaged cells. It's hard to know, but you focus on whether you need to treat or don't treat. You've called the disease idiopathic, the ventricular rhythm idiopathic. Now, what investigations are we going to do then? Depending on the cases, it's not uncommon to do echocardiography and check troponin. I see how much myocardial damage there is, do thoracic radiographs, and run a 24-hour Holter. Everything depends on the case, obviously. In cats, the vast majority are due to cardiomyopathies. So cardiomyopathies in cats, you can see a video there. I'm just going to play it. So this is a cat with an unclassified cardiomyopathy or a restricted cardiomyopathy. Looking at it now, it's not thickened, might be borderline thickened. There's a big, huge left atrium. And so any cardiomyopathy really would cause, again, any cardiac disease could cause, but because cardiomyopathies are so common and the most common cardiac disease in cats by far, then the most common causes are cardiomyopathy, either hypertrophic, restrictive, or unclassified, or dilated, but we know dilated is very uncommon in these days. Underlying diseases as important certainly as cardiac diseases for VPC. So many underlying diseases, if you've got VPCs, don't look just at the heart. You need to look at extracardiac causes. Any disease causing hypoxia, tissue hypoxia, or myocardial hypoxia. That will be diseases caused in shock, so abnormal perfusion to the myocardium. Diseases causing hypoxemia, so any respiratory disease causing a low PO2. Or anemia, which is obviously going to lead to decrease oxygen, tissue oxygen content in the myocardium, that could cause VPC. Any disease causing systemic inflammation, whether it's septic or non-septic, it's going to very likely with VPCs. Abdominal diseases, common one, splenic masses, severe effusions, GDV, pancreatitis, those are common ones that I'm sure we've all seen in practice. Electrolyte disorder, always just as a rule, any arrhythmia, you need to check the electrolytes because even if they are not the sole factor for the arrhythmia, they might be contributors to the arrhythmia. So they need to be always checked. Toxicity, put some there. A common one is digoxin toxicity, and that's why we have to be very careful with digoxin treatment in the always, but always measure levels, etc. If you see an arrhythmia that wasn't there before and happens during anesthesia and then goes away again, then you have to assume the disease. Yeah, you could check everything if depends on the circumstances, but it's very common. It's very likely that the arrhythmia has happened because of anesthesia itself. So because of the agents or because you've had a degree of myocardial hypoxia during the anesthetic, depending on what procedure you are doing. CNS diseases. Diseases with central neurological system disease can cause ventricular ectopy. And these often are thought to be also linked to changes in autonomic tone. So changes in so increased sympathetic tone, increased parasympathetic tone, abrupt changes from sympathetic to parasympathetic, those things can cause arrhythmia. More likely is an increase in sympathetic tone, but decrease as well could cause it will be through a different electrophysiological mechanism. So what are we going to do? Obviously, it depends on the case. I think you're going to do blood tests, abdominal thoracic imagings, 24-hour ECG monitoring, etc. Depending on the case, obviously, if they're young or dog. We tend to, and I just tell you, there's no guidelines, strict guidelines, but I can tell you, we tend to look a bit more into all dogs, in terms of thoracic imaging, abdominal imaging. So we do a quite full panel in all dogs. They're more likely to have neoplasia, etc. A bit less so in young dogs, but it's all obviously something that depends on the case. Fine. So now we've discussed about the potential causes for so with this we've done the description of the ventricular rhythm. We've talked about causes and what you have to bear in mind, basically, what tests to do. Now you've diagnosed the arrhythmia, you're happy with that. Now, what factors are we going to take into account when we decide whether we are going to treat the arrhythmia or we are not going to treat the arrhythmia? Okay. Now, this question can have more than one answer. if that's possible without test, I hope so. Fine. Very well. Very good. So basically, answers are coming as per primarily the underlying disease, whether it's transient or persistent. I like that. I think that's certainly a cause. We'll talk about it now. This has got is a bit of a questions, maybe not a trap, but it's a question where potentially all the answers are correct. Certainly, the complexity of the arrhythmia, we'll talk about it now. The hemodynamic consequences of the arrhythmia, 100%. The presence of clinical signs as well, that's taken into account for sure. The underlying disease as well, if it's transient or persistent. And certainly always, you're going to take the owner wishes. I think you could apply all of them. The importance is, yes, we're going to take all these factors into decide. Things are often not black and white, and you're just going to have to decide following this important factor. So the first one is complexity of the arrhythmia. So complexity of the arrhythmia, we are going to look whether single beats are better than couplets. Couplets are better than triplets. Triplets are better than ventricular tachycardia. When I look at that heart rate barrier that we've talked about, 180, below 180, most of the times, they might not need treatment unless it's something persistent. So if it's something associated with systemic disease, below 180, they will not need treatment usually. Above 180, we're going to start considering treatment. Okay. The morphology of the VPCs, we've said, if they are multiform, we might think that there is something more diffuse and we might get a bit more worried than if they are uniform. And RNT, if we see RNT how the one I've shown you before, that's worrying. And most likely we're going to start treatment, possibly not to prevent or to treat the VF, which cannot be treated really with tablets, but to try to prevent the number of ectopic or ectopy, to try to prevent the number of RNT episodes. So certainly if you look at it, this rhythm here, we know that that one you're not going to treat. You know that this one you're going to treat, but this one, you start considering treatment. Okay. So it's going to be the zone where you have to decide. Okay. But there's some clear ones. If you've got one ectopic in 24 hours, you're certainly not going to treat. If you've got this VTAC and a very rapid heart rate, then you're most likely going to need to treat. This one in between, you're possibly around 200 beats per minute, 180, 190. There's going to be a bit more decision making, taking other factors into account. And again, the last thing, sorry, I was going to say is the frequency of ventricular arrhythmia. So again, if you have what I've said, if you have a lot of arrhythmia over 24 hours, then you're more likely to treat than if it's just basically one or a couple of ectopics from time to time. Now, the second thing is, so you've looked at ECG, describe the complexity of the arrhythmia. And that's one feature. It's not only the ECG you need to look at when you treat ventricular arrhythmia. The ECG, we always say, no, don't treat the ECG, treat the dog. Yeah, and that's very important here. So, yeah, you know the complexity, and that's going to be a factor in treating the arrhythmia. You need to look at the dog. Has this arrhythmia, is this arrhythmia causing hemodynamic, is he having hemodynamic consequences? Or check the pulses, your mucous membrane, your blood pressure. Could potentially check lactate as well. Now, you have to be careful that you don't assume that everything is happening to the dog is because of the arrhythmia. If the dog has got severe sepsis, or if the dog is in congestive heart failure, or has got severe dilated cardiomyopathy, part of the hemodynamic consequences are going to be because of the underlying disease. So bear always this in mind. In cases where ventricular arrhythmia, but it's a case that is maybe it's not hospitalized, etc., you're going to look into their clinical signs. So two reasons for treatment will be, have we got, are, is this arrhythmia causing syncopal episodes? If it is, then you're going to want to treat the clinical signs, try to treat the clinical signs. Is there a risk of clinical signs or sudden death? It's difficult to estimate this, but basically if it looks very bad, you might want to treat because there's a risk of having clinical signs at some point or potentially sudden death. And the underlying diseases will be very important as well. It's not the same. We've got a video here of a a dog with dilated cardiomyopathy. So it's not the same if you've got a dog with dilated cardiomyopathy where you know the disease is going to be there always, all the time. It's going to be present all the time. Or if you've got like here, so you might say, well, I possibly need to treat because it's going to, if I think the arrhythmia is severe enough and it's causing problems, I'm going to have to treat because the disease is not going to go away. So the arrhythmia is unlikely to go away as well. As if you've got something like this, you've got pancreatitis. This is an abnormal pancreas there. And if you've got pancreatitis, you know the pancreatitis is going to hopefully resolve. And so you could potentially monitor a bit more, be more, less proactive with antiarrhythmics and wait and see. Because often the arrhythmia might go away once the underlying disease goes away. And obviously very different to processes where there is an escape rhythm. You've got escape rhythm and they don't need antiarrhythmic therapy. Those escape rhythms, you've got a third degree AV block. What they need is they need usually a pacemaker, or they need support of the bradyarrhythmia. The ventricular rhythm is a life-saving rhythm. It's a subsidiary. Pacemakers are managing to keep the heart going, but sometimes that's not for a long, long time, particularly in severe cases. You need to look at those things. So we've gone through the features and the appearance of the ECG, the potential underlying causes, and when you decide to treat. So decision making in terms of I'm going to decide to treat, you know, what can take you take into consideration. So let's say you have decided you need to treat. We're going to talk about specific treatment of the ventricular rhythm. The first thing of all, and I've gone through this quite a lot, is you are going to treat the underlying disease. You need to treat that underlying disease. That's very, very important. Cardiac disease, in particular congestive heart failure, specific treatment for that. If there's a systemic disease, you need to replace volume, you need to adjust electrolytes. If there is hypoxia, you need to treat aggressively. You know, if there is hypoxemia, for example, you need to treat the respiratory with oxygen, etc., etc. So you treat those underlying diseases very, very well. If that's been the case, you've treated the underlying diseases, then you're going to treat with antiarrhythmics. So the usual ones we use, are others, but I just put the most common ones that we use most of the times. So it's lidocaine, that would be the class 1B, sodium channel blocker. You're going to use it IV, first as a bolus and then an infusion. I'll show you a case in a second. Then we've got mexiletine, it's oral form, similar to lidocaine. So usually if a dog responds to lidocaine, possibly will respond to mexiletine as well. Mexiletine, I mean, can cause some GI signs, etc., but it's a good antiarrhythmic and is available now in most places, not in all countries, but certainly in the UK it's available. It's available again. It wasn't available for a few years. Sotalol is a class 3 and a class 2, a beta blocker, class 3 potassium channel blocker. It's very effective in many situations. It's a drug of choice for many ventricular arrhythmias in these days. But in very important, is a bit as a, every beta blocker, it can be a negative inotrope. So it can decrease your systolic function, your chronotropy. Okay. So your contractility, sorry, your chronotropy as well, but your contractility. So if obviously there is a risk of decreasing the contractility, you might actually worsen a heart failure, and actually you have to be very careful with beta blockers in congestive heart failure. You could easily, you know, have serious complications that lead to death, both in cats and in dogs. So be extremely careful with beta blockers in patients with severe advanced disease with systolic dysfunction, like cardiomyopathies, or patients in congestive heart failure. And the same goes for atenolol, another beta blocker, where, again, it can be used for ventricular arrhythmias, so you have to be careful. Amiodarone is more and more used as well. It's a class 3, 1. It's a bit of everything, but mainly it's class 3 and 1. It's got very good effects in many arrhythmias. You have to be careful. I always say I think it's better to check with a cardiologist if you're going to use these sort of antiarrhythmics, or that a cardiologist see the case and guides this. That's my advice. I think that the problem is it's got side effects, in particular liver toxicity, also acute GI signs, cause hypothyroidism, and has got a very long half-life. which means that it takes a long time to kick in. It takes some time, it takes some weeks to kick in. I mean, by day two, three, four, starting to kick in, and you can do loading doses. But it's, if it stays there for a long time, if you want to stop it. So if you say, oh, it's causing liver toxicity, let's stop it. Well, it's gonna take, usually if it's been there for a while, then it will take a few months to be fully eliminated. So you have to be careful and monitoring closely. I mean, we always say often you can monitor the same you would monitor phenobarbital, for example, in terms of measuring liver enzymes, et cetera. And you obviously need to check, hypothyroidism as well, T4 in particular in dogs that are predisposed to it. But again, I would advise to check with a cardiologist, and maybe it's better if a cardiologist sees the case. Personally, that's my advice. Now, if for dogs that do not respond to this, and we're starting to be in a tricky situation, you could use magnesium sulfate, which it's almost like a kind of, because a natural calcium blocker, and it might help. If it doesn't work, then you could defibrillate as well. So you've got a video there of we are defibrillating one dog there. And what we would do would be to, with a defibrillator, you will do that shock. So you can see we do it on the floor, because so they don't fall. They do have the parts attached to the dog, but we are not obviously doing the. I mean, you could do it yourself manually, but that decreases the risk of someone getting electrocuted, etc. So that would be something that, in cases that nothing is working, then that would be a solution for a potential treatment. So, for this, the internal defibrillators, they've been tried in a few dogs. At the moment, that's not so expensive, and the algorithms have not been developed for this. So what happened is, it seems to be shocking quite often, dogs shocking dogs quite often. So it's a because of the heart rate. So because often the algorithm, yes, shock for ventricular rhythms, but often shock as well, in terms of heart rate. So at the moment, that's not an option for dogs, and it's not nice as well. So it's not something that is, I don't think it's anyone is contemplating in the short term, to be honest, for dogs that have got recurrent VF, I mean, or severe VTachs that do not respond to other treatments. I think soon will be available as well, ablation of some ventricular ectopic focus as well. So that's another thing that will be coming as well. So I think one of the key things, and then I'll go to Casey. I'm just going to mention these. I've got lots of articles, etc. I'm just going to go through that. Just mentioning the main ideas I wanted to discuss, and then go through the couple of cases, which I think will be more interesting. First of all, what are our goals? I think it's important that the owner understands what the goals are, and obviously you are aware of this as well. Everyone is on the same tune, because we are good, so we can do treat clinical signs and improve hemodynamics. So dog is collapsing because of ventricular rhythms. You treat that, and then it collapses less or stop collapsing. We can do that. I think that's something we can improve the hemodynamics as well of a patient in the hospital. Now, when we talk about preventing risks or preventing sudden death, we don't know if we are doing or not. So if in a patient that is not having clinical signs, we really don't know if giving the antiarrhythmics is going to prevent the clinical signs. You would think so, but you have to bear in mind that antiarrhythmics are also proarrhythmics to some extent. And you're giving it in a dog with cardiac disease. So it's kind of a case-by-case situation, and certainly we don't know whether we prevented sudden death with this. There are no studies, and we really don't know. There are not many drugs that prevent with ventricular rhythms that prevent sudden death in humans, mainly amiodarone for some conditions, beta blockers, but they are different diseases, and the main treatment to prevent sudden death is an internal defibrillator for many of these patients in humans. So I think we have to bear that in mind. Okay, so basically the owner needs to understand we're giving an antiarrhythmic, but we're diminishing, hopefully, the risk of things happening. We're treating what's present, but we don't know whether we are really decreasing the risk of sudden death and or the appearance of clinical signs. A third point, which is coming, like it's becoming much, much more important, prominent, it wasn't that much 10 years ago, is the damage, the long-term damage that lots of ventricular rhythms can cause in the heart, in the ventricles. And it is, there are quite a few studies now showing, not in dogs, certainly, so this is all extrapolated from humans and from lab studies, etc., that has shown once and again that having a lot of ventricular rhythm, and the faster the worse, can cause remodeling of the heart and systolic dysfunction. So basically, if we've got lots of ventricular rhythm, we are going to decrease the we want to decrease the frequency of that ventricular activity to hopefully not having long-term effects. Another thing I say is in clinical from the clinical point of view, I think these dogs, and that's I've been changing over the years, and I used to work with a cardiologist who believed in this, and over the years she convinced me, and I think some dogs feel better, and many dogs just feel better. If they have loads of ventricular arrhythmia, you put them in treatment, and then they feel better. Again, this is not improvement. This is just an appreciation and something I think it happens. But we always it's hard to tell. And owners often say, "Oh, yes, but it's brighter. It's much. It seems to be doing things it wasn't doing for a while." But that's placebo. What is real? We really don't know. But the bottom line is you have to be humble and be realistic. Okay, so know your limitations, what we're trying to do, what we're doing, and the owners are aware of all this as well. I'm just going to pass all this and I'm just going to go through to the cases. I think that's more important than all these papers. Fine. So I'm going to go through these two cases. One is a Aussie who is a 4 years old border collie. The dog presented initially with severe weakness and anemia. He's got an IMHA. There's no evidence of underlying disease. And therapy for the IMHA has been started. After 24 hours, an arrhythmia is auscultated. Someone auscultates an arrhythmia. There are intermittent ectopics intercalated with a more regular rhythm and pulse deficits. And this is the rhythm. Okay, so look at it because I'm going to ask you now. I'll go back now. What rhythm do you think this is? It is a VTAC, an AF with conduction aberrancy, accelerated ventricular rhythm, atrial flutter with conduction aberrancy, or is this a third-degree AV block with escape rhythm? Go back again. You can have a look at it. VTAC, AF with aberrancy conduction, accelerated ventricular rhythm, atrial flutter. Fine. Okay, so all of you have said accelerated idioventricular rhythm, which I'm very happy with. And exactly, this is an accelerated ventricular rhythm. It's a ventricular rhythm with slow heart rate. Heart rate here is 160. I could have told you the heart rate because we don't have the, could have asked me, because we don't have the speed. But yes, this is a slow rhythm. It's an idioventricular rhythm. So heart rate is between 120 and 160. It's got this rhythm, Aussie. Blood pressure, respiratory rate, so hemodynamics are fine. What treatment would you implement in this dog? Lidocaine bolus followed by lidocaine CRI. Lidocaine bolus, a bit higher maximum dose, and then results after this lidocaine. Continuous ECG monitoring with no intervention. Ignore the arrhythmia and send the dog home as per his IMHA, or you would start with Sotalol. Very good. So everyone is saying continuous ECG monitoring. I think if there are no funds, you could potentially ignore the arrhythmia and send him home, but it seems a bit brave. So that's exactly what we did. So we monitor heart rate between 120 and 160. Monitor the arrhythmia. We continue with therapy, so blood transfusion, drugs, all these things for AMHA. And then he does well. His PCV increases to 30%, and there's no hemolysis. On day three, there's occasional VPCs, but that persistent, sustained rhythm, sustained is when we call it when it's more than 30 seconds, so sustained rhythm is almost gone. It's some VPCs. By day four, the arrhythmia has gone. There's normal sinus rhythm. This is typical of accelerated ventricular rhythm. We see this all the time. Any systemic disease, any disease causing hypoxias, etc., etc., etc. So these are heart rates I've discussed before. Might be slightly irregular sometimes, and that can be confusing, but it's just slightly irregular. Usually VTACs or ventricular rhythms are regular. These slower ones are a bit irregular just because of the mechanism. And usually these rhythms, so they are rhythms I've said before, which are caused by enhanced automaticity, ventricular pacemaker. Usually they don't have hemodynamic consequences. Usually they are self-limiting. And if the cause goes away, they go away. And usually they go away by 4 days, 5, 6, 7 days. So we give them a week. If by a week they haven't gone, then we might consider see what's happening. Okay, but 4 days, 5 days, usually they go away. Importantly, these rhythms might come in and out sinus rhythm, like we were saying. So if the rhythm, because they are slow rhythms, if the heart rate, because if the dog gets the stress, goes above 170, it might be that you see the sinus tachycardia. But then when the sinus beat goes lower, then you see the ventricular rhythm. And it's common that they come and go, come and go. And it's very common with these ones to see fusion complexes that I've said before. So fusion complexes, because the heart rates are kind of a similar speed. Fine. And then we're going to go through a second case, just to kind of as an example of ventricular rhythm. So this is Jasper, who is a 6-year-old boxer, 40 kilos. He's got a 3-month history of syncopal episodes on exercise, acute history of lethargy and collapse. Physical examination, heart rate 300 beats per minute, irregular, pale mucous membranes, and pulse deficits. We've got a heart rate of 300 mil, and there's certainly hemodynamic consequences there. And there are pulse deficits as well, which is a common characteristic of ventricular rhythm. Not only ventricular rhythms, you get that with AF, but certainly it's characteristic. And these are ECG. Someone's taking a blood test, and the bloods and electrolytes are normal. I'm going to ask now, what's your ECG diagnosis first? Is it a VTAC? Is it atrial fibrillation with conduction aberrancy, accelerated ventricular rhythm, atrial flutter with conduction aberrancy, supraventricular tachycardia with conduction aberrancy? So you must call it VTAC, which I think is correct. I think it'll be questions because, I mean, it possibly can't 100% rule out an SVT with conduction aberrancy with these cases, particularly we just seen 3 leads, etc. But yeah, this is typical VTAC until proven otherwise, I think. Now, how are you going to treat this suspected VTAC? You're going to give lidocaine boluses IV at 2 mg per kick, maximum 8 mg per kick, followed by lidocaine CRI. You're going to do continuous monitoring with no intervention. Sotalol at 2 mg per kick BID orally, increasing to 3 or 4 mg per kick as necessary. Diltiazem or pimobendan. Very happy. Everyone said lidocaine IV, and that's exactly what we did. I think if you give Sotalol on this case, it's not the last thing, it's not the worst thing in the world. I think Sotalol, usually you give it a tablet of Sotalol, usually start kicking in by 20, 30, 40 minutes. And so it will do something, and it will obviously start working quite quickly. And obviously, you don't know how the systolic function is, so you have to be careful with that. But I think if you don't have lidocaine, it's not the worst thing in the world. The others obviously are not applicable. And certainly, you don't want to just monitor this. Diltiazem is for supraventricular arrhythmia. Pimobendan is obviously a drug used for other, for inotropic support and vasodilation. So, what do we do with Jasper? We do exactly that. Lidocaine boluses, 2 mg per kick, twice, until we terminate the arrhythmia. And then we carry on with an infusion at 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute. And what we see is that There is occasional VPCs, but the ventricular tachycardia has gone. And this is very important. When you're treating, you're not treating to have an immaculate ECG. So you're treating to, you know, try to stop the VTAC. You're always going to have some ventricular rhythms going here and there most of the time. If you can do that, at least to slow the ventricular rhythm. Okay, so you will try to slow the ventricular rhythm. But when the dog is on the lidocaine infusion, we observe that VTAC is happening again, and it's sustained. So it's more than 30 seconds. We've got VTAC going all the time. What do? We repeat another bolus. And that's important with lidocaine. Lidocaine, it takes a few hours to get good levels. So you might have to repeat a couple of time boluses. Okay? So don't get to say, oh, it's not working. It usually works. Lidocaine usually, it's rare that it doesn't work. Sometimes it doesn't, but it's rare. And if it doesn't, usually it's because the dose is not correct. And then what do? We increase the infusion at 80 micrograms per kilogram per minute. We're trying, starting to go a bit high. We tend to use, you know, 25 to 100. That's in dogs. In cats, you have to be very careful. You possibly use less than, always less than 25. And you have to be careful. But basically, we go higher. You know, the higher you go, the more you're going to start seeing nausea, maybe neurological signs, etc., etc. But 80, well, often dogs tolerate it. So if you have to, you have to. And then once the dog is better, we will start with sotalol. Before we do that, while the dog is still on lidocaine, we're going to investigate. And then, yeah, once we've done that, I just should have put this on the other slide. Sotalol started, and we started on 2 mg/kg. Okay, you need to start on a decent dose of sotalol. But again, you need to investigate first, make sure that there is no systolic dysfunction. If there is systolic dysfunction, sotalol won't be your first severe systolic dysfunction. Sotalol won't be your first line of treatment. Certainly not if there is congestive heart failure. I'm going to go for mexiletine, potentially amiodarone as well. So with JASPA, we do echocardiography, which is unremarkable, abdominal image, thoracic radiographs, troponin levels. They're a bit high, but not too high, so that could just be secondary to the arrhythmia, so it doesn't add anything. What do? So we suspect this arrhythmia is idiopathic or secondary to arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, just because it's a boxer. Okay, could be idiopathic or arrhythmogenic. Haven't found any other cause for it. Treatment will be similar or will be the same, really. It's just trying to manage the arrhythmia. So on this dose of sotalol, 2 mg/kg, he goes home. We put a Holter on after 7 days. Jasper is asymptomatic. So he's asymptomatic, and we're happy with that. But on the Holter, we see that there is still 3,000 VPCs, a couplets, 100, triplets, 50, and there's still some episodes of VTAC at 300 beats per minute. So we think that's not, I mean, you could leave it, but it's a bit too much. So we increase the sotalol, see if we have more effect on that. And then to increase to 3 mg/kg, no side effects, symptomatic, asymptomatic. So side effects really for sotalol, main ones will be GI signs. So you always have to be careful with GI signs. And also, potentially you could have, you know, weakness, decreased blood pressure, things like that. Okay, so they might be slightly weaker. So you have to be careful with that. And then we repeat the Holter again after that, after a week. And then we see the VPCs are much less. There are 600, all uniforms, occasional couplets and triplets, but there's no VTAC anymore. So we think, well, this is fine. We're happy with this control now. We'll have a look at Jasper in 6 months. Okay. So I think those are two examples of how, you know, different ventricular rhythms mean different things. And you know, some you might want to treat, some others you might want to monitor. Okay. A few take-home messages I would put. Treat the dog and not the ECG. And that goes for when you decide treatments, look at the ECG, but also look at the consequences in the dog. Again, take into account the complexity of the arrhythmia, but also the consequences in the dog. Accelerated ventricular rhythm, very important, usually doesn't require treatments, usually resolves after a few days. And very commonly, we see all the time, associated with systemic disease. Very commonly, we call, cardiologists call, just to check the patient that is in, you know, in ICU or in ward, with systemic disease that has got an arrhythmia. So idioventricular rhythm, people get used to it. Then when new people come in, they get a bit more scared of it. And again, look into the potential hemodynamic effects of an arrhythmia and might be due to the underlying disease as well. So, if you've got effects, then they might not be due to the arrhythmia. Everything is not due to the arrhythmia, it might be due to the underlying disease. Lidocaine IV and sotalol, most common antiarrhythmic use. Be careful with sotalol. I've said before, I'm repeating a few things, but I think they're important. Again, treatment, yes, we treat the arrhythmia, but always treat the underlying disease. And often, might be able to treat the underlying disease first and then see what happens to the arrhythmia. Not always, but sometimes and often you will be. And again, be realistic. We are okay doing prevent. We are okay treatment treating the underlying the treating the consequences of the arrhythmia, the clinical signs, hemodynamic compromise. But there's less evidence in terms of preventing signs, improving survival, or whether remodeling is actually affecting dogs. But we've discussed all that. Just bear in mind that concept. Okay. Yeah, and I think we just bang on time, so I'm happy with that. And I didn't want to overrun it too much. And I think that's a summary of ventricular rhythms. Bear in mind everything we've discussed. And if you've got any questions, please ask me now, or you can send the questions to us, and we will be very happy to go back to you. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Domingo for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.